Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, May 1st, 2020. Every week we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news on books and reading. And once again, Andrew Albanese, PW senior writer, joins me from his home office in New York City. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
And as we do these days, Andrew, let's start with the important question during the COVID-19 pandemic. How are you and New York faring?
We are doing okay, still doing okay. Thank you for asking. And I'll point out that I do not have my own theme music. What you may be hearing in the background is my son taking a virtual piano lesson. we're making out okay here. This week, the number of dead surpassed 60,000. So that's a sad milestone for the country. And that's surely an undercount, given that, you know, that only really counts people who died in hospitals and nursing homes. The unemployed surpassed 30 million, I believe. GDP tanked about 5%. That's a stunning number. But we're still working, still healthy here in New York City, and we're still committed to staying home and saving lives. So, and I trust you're doing well too, Chris?
Well, I have managed to stay out of trouble so far, Andrew. Thanks for asking as well. And at least here in Boston, it has been, or it was, a rainy, chilly April. So I am hoping that means great Mayflowers, or I'm calling customer service. Anyway, this week, Publishers Weekly reported on numbers from the Association of American Publishers for the first 2 months of 2020. And taken with that drop in GDP that you mentioned, which came late in the first quarter of this year, it makes you wonder about what might have been, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. You know, through February, publishing industry sales were up a pretty healthy 3.5%. That's for the first 2 months of 2020 over 2019. And that's according to sales that were supplied by the Association of American Publishers, the 1,361 publishers in their StatShop program. So we had a 3.7% monthly increase in January. Sales were up 3.1% in February. And I'll point out that book sales for the end of this, for this week, were up 10%. So pretty solid gains. You know, book sales seem to be hanging on in the pre-COVID-19 era, but that's certainly about to end. When the March results come in, for the monthly March results come in, they're obviously going to be way down. Once again, though, for the first 2 months, the numbers were good. And digital audio sales were once again driving those gains for the first 2 months. They were up 17.2%. The format accounted for 13% of adult trade sales. That's just an astounding figure to me. 13% of adult trade sales are now audio. I could not have conceived of that a decade ago, but here we are. Notably, though, that's, you know, only up about 1% from a year ago. That, you know, 12%, I think, was the amount of sales that digital audio accounted for in 2019. And that makes me wonder if we're starting to see a plateau. You know, after years of skyrocketing sales of digital audio over the last 5-7 years, I wonder if we're starting to sort of level out at 13%. On the print side, hardcover and trade paperback sales were up 5.8% and 6.4% respectively. And ebooks were down 6%. And that's a number to watch too, because I expect that number is going to change dramatically. It's going to be interesting to see how the stay-at-home orders in March will have boosted the digital format.
You reported this week, Andrew, on an important copyright-related U.S. Supreme Court decision, a ruling that could shake up legal publishing and more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's been quite a copyright bottleneck to start 2020. You know, we had the third decision in the Georgia State e-reserves case. We had the Internet Archive stirring the mix with the National Emergency Library. And on Monday, the Supreme Court weighed in with a major ruling that could shake up the legal publishing realm and potentially hold even wider implications for states that own copyrights. In a 5-4 opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts, the High Court held that annotations to the state of Georgia's legal code, essentially the laws of the state, were not eligible for copyright protection. Now, that ruling upholds a 2018 appeals court decision by the 11th Circuit, and the 11th Circuit actually reversed a 2017 summary judgment in the case, which is Georgia versus publicresource.org. And in that case, the state of Georgia sued a public access advocacy group, public resource, for copyright infringement, for making the state's complete annotated legal code, which is published commercially by the LexisNexis Group, freely available online. So in a nutshell, the court held that even though the legislature outsourced work to a private company to create these annotations to their legal code, that work was done in the course of their legislative duties, and under what's known as the government edicts doctrine, are therefore not eligible for copyright protections. In the decision, Roberts explained that the animating principle behind the government edicts doctrine is that no one can own the law, and that officials who are empowered to speak with the force of law cannot be authors of, and therefore cannot copyright, the works they create in the course of their official duties.
GeorgiaVPublicResource.org is a case with wide-ranging implications, certainly, and it even has an intriguing backstory.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. It really is. The history of it is quite something. So basically, it revolves around the publication of the Official Code of Georgia Annotated. Now, while that publication does not claim copyright over the text of the actual statutes themselves, what's at issue here are the accompanying annotations. And the annotations include summaries of judicial decisions and other references, like in even editor's notes, for example. And as Roberts explained in his decision, even though these annotations are not actual laws, they don't have the force of law, they're still vital. For instance, Georgia still has a law in the books making sodomy a crime. But the annotation lets the reader know that that law has since been held unconstitutional, even though lawmakers haven't gotten around to, you know, taking it off the books. Anyway, to create these annotations, Georgia contracted Matthew Bender and Company, which is a division of LexisNexis, and they did so under a work-for-hire agreement. Under that agreement, the state claims copyright ownership of the work and in exchange grants LexisNexis an exclusive license to publish the work commercially. Now, the price of that work is capped. I think it's $412 in print for 54 volumes, and there's also digital access. And there's also some arrangement for people to access it through libraries. But in the digital age, you know, these kind of public-private publishing arrangements are coming under increased scrutiny. And enter longtime public advocate Carl Malamud and the nonprofit advocacy group he founded called Public Resource. Now, that's an organization that is committed to making taxpayer-funded government documents widely available to the public. And in an effort to press the issue of who owns the law, to press the issue of public access to official laws and legal documents, Public Resource scanned and posted a free version of this publication in 2013 and started distributing it on thumb drives. You know, just they're provoking, and they got, as intended, I suppose, a lawsuit from the state of Georgia for copyright infringement. And in that lawsuit, Georgia contended that each of the annotations contained in that publication, which LexisNexis publishes, is an original and creative work of authorship. But because Georgia's annotations are in effect authored by an arm of the legislature, Roberts held, in fact, they are outside of the reach of copyright protection. And what's really fascinating about this case to me, too, is that it's not often that these kind of activist cases get to the high court. And even though Public Access won at the appeals court level and there was no circuit split, Public Resource actually joined with the state of Georgia to weigh in and ask the Supreme Court to take the case and settle the question once and for all, which the court has now done.
Indeed, a 5-4 decision, though, would suggest that it wasn't exactly an open and shut case. And moreover, this judgment didn't fall along the usual SCOTUS partisan lines. What was the argument for the minority?
Yeah, so it did not fall along the usual partisan lines because you had Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Clarence Thomas writing dissents in this case. In his lengthy dissent, Judge Clarence Thomas noted that 25 other jurisdictions, 22 states, 2 territories, and the District of Columbia currently rely on similar publishing arrangements to produce their annotated state codes. And he argued that creators of these annotations are, in fact, incentivized by copyright law to produce a desirable product. And he mused that perhaps to the detriment of all, many states are just going to stop producing these annotated codes altogether if they can't copyright and sell them commercially. And because this is what I like to do, you know me well at this point, and I have a little free time on my hands these days. You know, I spent a lot of time this week reading the amicus briefs in this case, and there are a lot of them. And in its 2019 amicus brief, lawyers for LexisNexis echoed exactly what Thomas said. If Georgia's copyright is destroyed and LexisNexis loses the exclusive right to sell the annotations, LexisNexis isn't going to create them anymore unless Georgia pays up front for the work with taxpayer funds. What's interesting here, though, is that's exactly how it should be, Public Resource argued. In fact, in its 2019 brief urging the court to take up the case, which is a really great brief, I have to say, Carl Malamud argues that Georgia made the decision to farm out this publication to Lexis rather than pay Lexis for the work and then keep the copyright for itself. Effectively, what they were doing is manufacturing an exclusive right in new work by refusing to pay a contractor for it. The state could easily ensure publication of these annotations by creating them using their own staff or just by paying Lexis the way it pays other contractors. You know, writing for the majority, this is a key part of the decision. Roberts evoked a public legal and legislative arena that is more complicated than incentivized by copyright. He pointed out, for example, that unlike other intellectual property protections, like patents, for example, copyrights are instant and automatic. Meaning as soon as you write something down, effectively that's copyrighted. And copyrights can last for well over a century. We know we have an orphan works problem because those terms do run so long. And you look at it this way, for example, you know, if the states didn't take the affirmative step of transferring their copyrights to the public domain, Roberts points out, all of its judges and legislators' non-binding legal works that weren't actually part of a legislative code, weren't actually done with the force of law, they'd be copyrighted. And citizens, attorneys, nonprofits, researchers, whatever, would basically have to worry or stop all copying and distribution of these works or risk being brought up, you know, for copyright infringement, facing, you know, potentially criminal penalties. On the other hand, the Copyright Alliance, in their brief to the court, warned that a ruling in favor of Public Resource was going to invalidate hundreds, if not thousands, of copyrights that are currently owned by states, and that it would upend a long existing publication system that's existed for over a century. However, I would point out that publication system was upended already by this thing called the internet. You know, maybe you've heard of it. The economic reality, they argued, is that states cannot afford to annotate their own laws. And I just got to say, I think that's a shockingly weak argument. The idea that government can't afford to do the most basic work of updating and annotating its legal code without a complex copyright regime being attached, I just find that to be absurd. But on that potential scenario, Roberts punted the issue to Congress. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, but either way, that's Congress's job to fix that.
Finally, a major copyright decision by the Canadian Court of Appeal has Canadian publishers and authors concerned.
Yeah, another fascinating copyright case to start off 2020. In a statement this week, the Association of Canadian Publishers is saying that Canada's copyright framework is broken. This after an appeals court dealt Canadian publishers and authors a major setback in what's been a very closely watched copyright case for the better part of the decade. Now, this is Canada and it's Canadian copyright, so I'm not as versed in it as I am in U.S. copyright, but fascinating case. And we'll run down the backstory here. On April 22nd, the Canadian Federal Court of Appeal upheld a lower court decision in this long-running case, which is Access Copyright versus York University. And that decision held that the copying guidelines being used by York University in Toronto did not comply with the Canadian Supreme Court's test for fair dealing. In other words, infringement. But in a major blow, the court also held that the so-called tariff payments for the university's copying, and these rates are set by the Canadian government's National Copyright Board, are not mandatory because York University had actually opted out of the tariff regime and ended its license agreement with Access Copyright back in 2011. So for a little more background here, Access Copyright is sort of like the Canadian CCC, right? They're a collective society. They represent thousands of authors and some, I believe, 650 publishers. And in 2013, Access Copyright filed suit against York University, alleging that they were using their fair dealing guidelines to basically avoid paying copyright tariffs for materials that were being used in the classroom. And now two courts, the district court, the federal court, and the appeals court have now found that indeed York is using those guidelines incorrectly. But this is not a copyright infringement case. Access Copyright can't sue for infringement. This case is about the tariff system in Canada. And on that score, despite upholding that York University's copyright guidelines were not fair dealing, the court ruled that the copyright board, their role is to approve and not implement these tariffs. And because York University opted out of the tariff system in 2011 after balking at paying higher rates after the 2010 deal expired, the court held that York is actually not bound by those tariffs. I'll read the line from the decision that resonated with me. Acts of infringement do not turn infringers into licensees so as to make them liable for the payment of royalties, the court held.
Well, only a court could write such a thing, and it seemed to make sense. It does seem to make sense. It's a little confusing, but where are we left? What happens next?
Well, that is the question. Where are we left? So in a statement, Access Copyright, on behalf of its many members, said it's considering next steps, and that could include a possible appeal to Canada's Supreme Court. Now, to be clear, the decision does not leave copyright holders without recourse. You know, twice they've been found that it's been found that these fair dealing guidelines were not accurately applied. But this would require copyright owners individually to sue for infringement and damages, which they can do. But given the high cost of litigation for individual authors and small publishers, the Association of Canadian Publishers says, come on, that's simply not feasible. In essence, the decision reaffirms that York has been engaging in, and I'll quote the ACP here, illegal and unfair copying on a systematic basis. Yet at the same time, it makes the prospect of enforcement for small and medium-sized publishers and authors impossible, because the cost of litigation, as we say, is just too high. So it ends up sort of striking at the heart of this whole system, right? It makes these collectives futile, the Association of Canadian Publishers say. And the situation has actually been exacerbated, they argue, by the 2012 copyright reforms in Canada, which ACP says have contributed to a major decline in collective licensing revenue across the industry, as much as 80% in some years. To date, ACP puts the cumulative loss at around 150 million Canadian. So, you know, what I will note here is that as contentious as this case is, what's been notable to me throughout this litigation is that the comments and the language used by the organizations here have been pretty measured and really polite, certainly by U.S. standards, very polite. And one hopes that bodes well for an equitable solution. You know, in its release, the ACP is calling on legislators in Canada to move to correct the market damage that's been done and to provide a policy framework that will, you know, support future investments in Canadian writing and publishing. And it's also urging the education sector to come back to the table and negotiate with authors and publishers. And I point this out because, you know, none of these releases, nowhere does anyone call anyone a thief or suggest that what's going on is immoral or deceitful. You know, it's really something. It's a deep, deep disagreement. But there hangs over it this hope that there's going to be a compromise. And I hope it comes soon. And I hope it sets an example for other territories that are struggling with similar challenges, which is, you know, how, of course, to properly incentivize and reward creators and publishers and also best serve the needs of the public for things like education.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me today and every Friday.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming next on Beyond the Book, when reporters cite numbers related to the coronavirus pandemic, they usually are an accounting of fearsome milestones. So many new cases in one state or another country, so many more deaths within a hot zone of illness. Yet not all numbers in COVID-19 are quite so bleak. According to the research data platform Dimensions, nearly 15,000 journal publications have appeared related to the pandemic in just a few short months since the disease emerged. Mike Taylor, head of metrics development for digital science, whose portfolio of companies includes Dimensions as well as Altmetric, says the achievement is about more than medical research activity.
This is a unique moment in scientific research communication history. It's extraordinary to see how quickly researchers are focusing on this problem. And also really interesting to see who's doing this work. Whereabouts is this work happening? So, for example, you know, we might think of this as being purely a medical issue or an issue of virology or epidemiology. Actually, there are all sorts of things going on here. You know, we're seeing people talking about planning and tourism and travel, communication, public health. Really, this is one virus, but it's a phenomena in 12, 13, 14 different fields. Understanding that and understanding how we listen to research is really interesting.
COVID-19 by the numbers, next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.